Chapter 13. Resurgam Orbit 2566. Seat, Bolyova said, entering the bridge. A chair craned eagerly towards her. She buckled herself in and then gunned the seat away from the bridge's tiered walls, until she was orbiting the enormous holographic projection sphere which occupied the room's middle. The sphere was showing a view of Resurgam, although one might have easily concluded that it was really the desiccated eyeball of an ancient and mummified corpse, magnified several hundred times. But Volyova knew that the image was more than just an accurate portrayal of Resurgam, dredged from the ship's database. It was being imaged in real time, captured by the cameras which were even now pointing down from the lighthugger's hull. Resurgam was not a beautiful planet, by anyone's standards. Apart from the sullied white of the polar caps, the overall color was a skullish gray, offset by scabs of rust and a few desultory chips of powder blue near the equatorial zones. The larger oceanic water masses were still mostly cored under ice, and those motes of exposed water were almost certainly being artificially warmed against freeze-over, either by thermal energy grids or carefully tailored metabolic processes. There were clouds, but they were wispy plumes rather than the great complex features Volyova knew one could usually expect from planetary weather systems. Here and there they thickened towards white opacity, but only in small ganglia knots near the settlements. Those were the places where the vapor factories were working, sublimating polar ice into water, oxygen, and hydrogen. There were few patches of vegetation large enough to be seen without magnification down to kilometer resolution, and by the same token, no obvious visible evidence of human presence, save for a sprinkling of settlement lights when the planet's night side rolled around every 90 minutes. Even with the zoom, the settlements were elusive, since, with the exception of the capital, they tended to be sunk into the ground. Often, very little projected beyond the surface apart from antennae, landing pads, and air-smoothed greenhouses. Of the capital? Well, that was the disturbing part. "When does our window with Triumvir Sajaki open?" she asked, snapping her gaze across the faces of the other crew members, whose seats were arranged in a loosely defined cluster, facing each other beneath the ashen light of the imaged plant.
5 minutes, Egazi said. 5 tortuous minutes, and then we'll know what delights dear Sajaki has to share with us regarding our new colonist friends. Are you sure you can bear the agony of waiting? Why don't you have a guess, Shvinoi? That wouldn't be much of a challenge, would it?
Egazi was grinning, or at least trying very hard to approximate the gesture, no mean feat given the amount of chimeric accessories which encrusted his face.
Funny, if I didn't know you better, I'd say you weren't exactly enthralled by any of this. If he hasn't found Sylvester.
Egazi raised a gauntleted hand.
Sajaki hasn't even made his report yet. No sense jumping the gun.
You're confident he'll have found him then?
Well, no. I didn't say that.
If there's one thing I hate, Volyova said, looking coldly at the other triumvir, it's mindless optimism.
Oh, cheer up. Worse things happen.
Yes, she had to admit, they did. And with an annoying regularity, they seemed to have decided to keep happening to her. What was astonishing about her recent run of misfortune was that it had managed to keep escalating with each new bout of bad luck. It had reached the point where she was beginning to look back nostalgically on the merely irksome problems she had encountered with Nagorni, when all she had to deal with was someone trying to kill her. It made her wonder, without a great deal of enthusiasm, if there would soon come a day when she would look back even on this period with longing. The trouble with Nagorni had been the precursor, of course. It was obvious now. At the time, she had regarded the whole thing as an isolated incident. But what it had really been was just the initial indications of something far worse in the future, like a heart murmur presaging an attack. She had killed Nagorni, but in doing so she had not come to any understanding of the problem that had driven him psychotic. Then she had recruited Kuri, and the problems had not so much repeated themselves as reiterated a grander theme, like the second movement of a grim symphony. Kuri was not obviously mad, yet. But she had become a catalyst for a worse, less localized madness,
There had been the storms in her head, beyond anything Volyova had ever seen. And then there had been the incident with the cash weapon, which had almost killed Volyova, and might have gone on to kill all of them, and perhaps a significant number of the people on Resurgam as well. "It's time for some answers, Kuri," she had said, before the others were revived. "Answers about what, Triumvir?" "Forget the charade of innocence," Volyova said. "I'm far too tired for it, and I assure you I will get to the truth, one way or the other. During the crisis with the cash weapon, you gave too much away. If you were hoping I would forget some of the things you said, you were mistaken."
"Like what?"
"They were down in one of the rat-infested zones. It was, Volyova reckoned, as safe from Sajaki's listening devices as any area of the ship, save the spider room itself." She shoved Kuri against the wall, hard enough to knock some wind out of the woman, letting her know Volyova's wiry strength should not be underestimated, nor her patience stretched too far.
"Let me make something clear to you, Kuri. I killed Nagorny, your predecessor, because he failed me. I successfully concealed the truth of his death from the rest of the crew. Be under no illusions that I will do the same to you, if you give me sufficient justification."
Kuri pushed herself back from the wall, regaining some color. "What is it you want to know exactly? You can start by telling me who you are. Begin with the assumption that I know you are an infiltrator."
"How can I be an infiltrator? You recruited me."
"Yes," Volyova said, for she had already thought this through. "That was the way it was made to seem, of course. But it was deception, wasn't it? Whatever agency is behind you managed to manipulate my search procedure, making it seem as if I had selected you, whereas the choice was ultimately not mine at all." Volyova had to admit to herself that she had no direct evidence to support this, but it was the simplest hypothesis which fitted all the facts.
"So, are you going to deny this? Why would you think I was an infiltrator?"
Volyova paused to light up a cigarette, one of those she had bought from the stoners in the carousel where Kuri had been recruited, or found.
"Because you seem to know too much about the gunnery. You seem to know something about Sunstealer, and that troubles me deeply.
You mentioned Sunstealer shortly after you brought me aboard, don't you remember?"
"Yes, but your knowledge goes deeper than can be explained by the information you could have gleaned from me. In fact, there are times when you seem to know somewhat more about the whole situation than I do."
She paused. "There's more to it than that, of course. The neural activity in your brain, during reefer sleep. I should have examined the implants you came aboard with more carefully. They obviously aren't all that they seem. Do you want to have a stab at explaining any of this?"
"All right."
Kuri's tone of voice was different now. It was clear that she had given up any hope of bluffing her way out of this one. "But listen carefully, Ilya. I know you've got your little secrets, too. Things you really don't want Sajaki and the others to find out. I'd already guessed about Nagorny. But there's also the business with the cash weapon. I know you don't want that to become common knowledge, or you wouldn't be going to such lengths to cover up the whole thing." Volyova nodded, knowing it would be fruitless to deny these things. Maybe Kuri even had an inkling of her relationship with the captain.
"What are you saying?"
"I'm saying whatever I say to you now, it had better stay between us.
Isn't that reasonable of me?"
"I just said I could kill you, Kuri. You're not exactly in a strong bargaining position."
"Yes, you could kill me, or at least have a go.
But despite what you said, I doubt you'd manage to cover up my death as easily as you did Nagorny's. Losing one gunnery officer is bad luck. Two begins to look like carelessness, doesn't it?" A rat scampered by, splashing them. Irritatedly, Volyova flicked her cigarette butt towards the animal, but it had already vanished through a duct in the wall.
"So you're saying I don't even tell the others I know you're an infiltrator?"
Kuri shrugged.
"You do what you like. But how do you think Sajaki would take that? Whose fault would it have been that the infiltrator ever came aboard in the first place?"
Volyova took her time before answering.
"You've got it all worked out, haven't you? I knew you'd want to ask me some questions sooner or later, Triumvir. So let's start with the obvious one. Who are you, and who are you working for?"
Kuri sighed and spoke with resignation. A lot of what you already know is the truth. I'm Anna Kuri, and I was a soldier on Sky's Edge, although about 20 years earlier than you thought. As for the rest... She paused. You know, I could really use some coffee. There isn't any, so get used to it. All right. I was in the pay of another crew. I don't know their names. There was never any direct contact. But they've been trying to get their hands on your cash weapons for some time. Volyova shook her head. Not possible. No one else knows about them. That's what you'd like to think. But you have used parts of the cash, right? There must have been survivors, witnesses, you never knew about. Gradually word got about that your ship was carrying some serious shit. Maybe no one knew the whole picture, but they knew enough of it to want to have their own slice of the cash. Volyova was silent. What Kuri was saying was shocking, like finding out that her most private of habits was public knowledge. But, she had to admit, not beyond the bounds of possibility. Conceivably there had been a leak. Crew had left the ship, after all, not always willingly, and while those who had done so were not supposed to have had access to anything sensitive, certainly nothing pertaining to the cash, there was always the chance that an error had been made. Or perhaps, as Kuri had said, someone had witnessed the cash being used and had lived to pass on that information. This other crew, you may not have known their names, but did you know what their ship was called? No. That would have been just as sloppy as letting me know who they were, wouldn't it? What did you know in that case? How were they expecting to steal the cash from us? That's where Sunstealer comes into it. Sunstealer was a military virus they snuck aboard your ship when you were last in the Yellowstone system. A very smart adaptive piece of infiltration software. It was designed to worm its way into enemy installations and wage psychological warfare on the occupants, driving them mad through subliminal suggestion. Kuri paused, giving Volyova time to digest that. But your own defenses were too good. Sunstealer was weakened, and the strategy never really worked. So they bided their time. They didn't get another chance until you were back in the Yellowstone system nearly a century later. I was the next line of attack. Get a human infiltrator aboard. How was the original viral attack made? They got in via Sylvest. They knew all about you bringing him aboard to fix up your captain. They planted the software on him without him knowing, then let it infect your systems while he was hooked into your medical suite, fixing the captain. There was, Volyova thought, something deeply and worryingly plausible about that. It was just an example of another crew being as predatory as they were. It would be arrogance in the extreme to assume that only Sajaki's triumvirate were capable of such subterfuge. And what was your function? To assess the state of Sunstealer's corruption of your gunnery systems. If possible, to gain control of the ship. Resurgium was a good destination for that, sufficiently out of the way not to be under any kind of system-wide police jurisdiction. If a takeover could be staged, there would be no one to observe it except maybe a few colonists. Kuri sighed. But believe me, that plan's well and truly shit-canned. The Sunstealer program was flawed, too dangerous and too adaptive. It drew too much attention to itself when it drove Nagorny mad. But on the other hand, he was the only one it could reach. Then it started screwing around with the cash itself. The rogue weapon. Yeah, that scared me as well. Kuri shivered. I knew Sunstealer was too powerful by then. There was nothing I could do to control it. Over the next few days, Volyova would ask Kuri more questions, testing different aspects of her story against what passed for the known facts. Certainly, Sunstealer could have been some kind of infiltration software, even if it was more subtle, more insidious than anything she had heard of in all her years of experience. But did that mean she could dismiss it? No, of course not. After all, she knew the thing existed. Kuri's story, in fact, was the first explanation she had encountered that made any kind of objective sense at all. It explained why her attempts to cure Nagorny had failed. He had not been sent mad by any subtle combination of effects stemming from her gunnery implants. He had been driven mad, purely and simply, by an entity that had been designed for just that purpose. No wonder it had been so hard to find any explanation for Nagorny's problems. Of course, there remained the irksome question of why exactly Nagorny's madness had expressed itself so forcefully in the manner it had. All those fevered sketches of nightmarish birds' parts, and the designs on his coffin. But who was to say that Sunstealer had not simply amplified some pre-existing psychosis, letting Nagorny's subconscious work with whatever imagery suited it? The mysterious other crew could also not be dismissed too easily. Shipboard records revealed that another lighthugger, the Galatea, had been present in Yellowstone on both occasions when they had last visited the system. Could they have been the crew responsible for sending Curry aboard? For now, it was as good an explanation as any. And one thing was absolutely clear. Curry was quite right in saying that none of this information could be presented to the rest of the triumvirate. Sajaki would indeed blame Volyova totally for what was a grievous lapse in security. He would punish Curry, of course. But Volyova could also expect some kind of retribution. The way their relationship had been strained of late, it was entirely possible that Sajaki would try and kill her. He might succeed, too. He was at least as strong as Volyova. It would not greatly trouble him that he would be losing his chief weapons expert and the only person who had any real insight into the cache. His argument would no doubt be that she had already demonstrated her incompetence in that regard. But there was something else, too, something Volyova could not entirely dismiss. No matter what had really transpired with the cache weapon, the unavoidable truth was that Curry had saved Volyova's life. Hateful though the thought was, she owed the infiltrator. Her only option, when she considered the situation dispassionately, was to proceed as if nothing had happened. Curry's mission was in any case no longer viable. There would be no attempted takeover now. The woman's hidden reason for being aboard the ship had no impact on the upcoming attempt to bring Sylvester aboard again, and in many respects, Curry would be needed simply as a crew member. Now that Volyova knew the truth, and now that the original purpose of Curry's mission had been abandoned, Curry would surely do everything in her power to fit into her pre-assigned position. It hardly mattered whether the loyalty treatments were working or not. Curry would have to behave as if they were, and gradually the act would become indistinguishable from the truth. She might not even want to leave the ship when the opportunity arose to do so. After all, there were worse places to be. Over months or years of subjective time, she would become one of the crew, and her past duplicity could remain a secret shared only by her and Volyova. In time, it might even be something Volyova almost forgot. Eventually, Volyova managed to convince herself that the infiltration question had been settled. Sunstealer would remain a problem, of course, but now Curry would be working with her to conceal it from Sajaki. And in the meantime, there were other things that needed to be concealed from the Triumvir. Volyova had set herself the task of eradicating every shred of evidence that the cache weapon incident had ever happened. She intended to do this before Sajaki and the others were revived, but it had not proved easy. Her first task had been to repair the damage to the lighthugger itself, patching the areas of the hull which had been hurt by the weapons detonation. Largely this consisted of coaxing the auto-repair routines to work faster, but she also had to ensure that all pre-existing scars, impact craters, or areas of imperfect repair were precisely duplicated. She then had to hack into the auto-repair memory and erase the knowledge that the repairs had been orchestrated at all. She had to repair the spider room, even though Sajaki and the others were not meant to know it even existed. Better to be safe than sorry, though, and that had been by far the simplest of the repairs. Next, she had to erase all evidence that the palsy routine had been run, at least a week's work. The loss of the shuttle was much harder to hide. For a while, she considered making a new one, harvesting tiny amounts of raw materials from all over the ship, until she had what she needed. She would only have to use 1/90,000th of the entire mass of the ship, but it was too risky, and she doubted her ability to weather the shuttle authentically, to make it look as old as it should have been. Instead, she took the simpler option of editing the ship's database, so that it would always look as if there had been one shuttle fewer aboard. Sajaki might notice, all the crew might notice, but there would be absolutely nothing that anyone could prove. Finally, of course, she remade the cache weapon. It was only a facade, a replica designed to lurk in the cache chamber and look threatening on the rare occasions when Sajaki paid a visit to her domain. Covering her tracks took 6 days of manic work. On the 7th day she rested, and endeavored to compose herself, so that none of the others would guess what labors she had been through. On the 8th day, Sajaki had awakened and asked her what she had been up to in the years he had been in reef asleep. "Oh," she had said, "nothing to write home about." His reaction, like much else about Sajaki these days, had been difficult to judge. Even if she had succeeded this time, she thought, she could not risk another mistake. Yet already, though they had not even made contact with the colonists, things were drifting beyond the arena of her understanding. Her thoughts returned to the neutrino signature she had detected around the system's neutron star, and of the feeling of unease which had been with her ever since. The source was still there, and while it remained weak, she had now studied it well enough to know that it was in orbit not just around the neutron star, but also around the moon-sized rocky world which attended the star. It had certainly not been present when the system had been surveyed decades earlier, immediately suggesting that it was something to do with the colony on Resurgam. But how could they have sent it? The colonists did not even seem capable of reaching orbit, let alone sending some kind of probe to the edge of their system. Even the ship, which should have brought them here, was missing. She had expected to find the Lorian in orbit around Resurgam, but there was no sign of it. Now, no matter what the evidence said, she kept in the back of her mind the possibility that the colonists might be capable of something completely unexpected. It was another burden to add to her mounting stockpile of worries.
"Ilya," said Hegazi, "we're almost ready now. The capital's about to emerge from Nightside."
She nodded. The ship's high magnification cameras, dotted around the hull, would be zooming in on a very specific site several kilometers beyond the city boundary, focusing on a spot which had been identified and agreed upon before Sajaki's departure. If no misfortune had befallen him, he would now be waiting at that spot, standing on the upper surface of an unshielded mesa, looking directly towards the rising sun. Timing was critical here, but Valiova did not doubt that Sajaki would be on the mark.
"Got him," Hegazi said. "Image stabilizers phasing in. Show us."
A window opened in the globe near the capital, rapidly swelling. At first what lay within the window was unclear, a blurred smear that might have been a man standing on a rock. But the image quickly sharpened, until the figure was recognizably Sajaki. In place of the bulky adaptive armor which Valiova had last seen him wearing, Sajaki wore an ash-colored overcoat, its long tails flapping around his booted legs, evidencing the mild wind playing over the mesa's topside. The suit's collar was drawn up around his ears, but his face was unobstructed. It was not quite his own. Prior to leaving the ship, Sajaki's features had been subtly remolded, according to an averaged ideal derived from the genetic profiles of the original expedition members who had traveled to Resurgam from Yellowstone, in turn reflecting the Franco-Sino genes of the Yellowstone settlers. Sajaki would arouse nothing more than a curious glance if he chose to walk through the capital streets at midday. There was nothing to betray him as a newcomer, not even his accent. Linguistic software had analyzed the dozen or so stoner dialects carried by the expedition members, applying complex lexicostatistic models to merge these modes of speech into a new planet-wide dialect for Resurgam as a whole. If Sajaki chose to communicate with any of the settlers, his look, cover story, and manner of speaking would convince them that he was merely from one of the remoter planetary settlements, not an off-worlder. That, at least, was the idea. Sajaki carried no technological implements which would give him away, save the implants beneath his skin. A conventional surface-to-orbit communication system would have been too susceptible to detection, and far too difficult to explain, had he been captured for some reason or other. Yet now he was speaking, reciting a phrase repeatedly, while the ship's infrared sensors examined the blood flow around Sajaki's mouth region, assembling a model of his underlying muscular and jaw movements. By correlating these movements against the extensive archives of actual conversation already recorded, the ship could begin to guess the sounds he was making. The final step was to include grammatical, syntactical, and semantic models for the words Sajaki was likely to be saying. It sounded complex, it was, but to Volyova's ears there was no perceptible time lag between his lip movements and the simulated voice she was hearing, eerily clear and precise. "I must presume you can now hear me," he said. "For the record, let this be my first report from the surface of Resurgam after landing. You will forgive me if I occasionally digress from the point, or express myself with a certain inelegance. I did not write this report down beforehand. It would have constituted too great a security risk if I were found with it while leaving the capital. Things are very different than we expected." True enough, Volyova thought. The colonists, or at least a faction of them, certainly knew that a ship had arrived around Resurgam. They had bounced a radar beam off it, surreptitiously. But they had made no attempt to contact Infinity, no more so than the ship had attempted to contact anyone on the ground. As much as the neutrino source. That worried her. It spoke of paranoia and hidden intentions, and not just her own. But she forced herself not to think about that now, for Sajaki was still speaking, and she did not want to miss any of what he had to report. "I have much to tell concerning the colony," he said, "and this window is short, so I will begin with the news you are undoubtedly waiting for. We have located Sylvest. Now it is simply a matter of bringing him into our custody." Sluka was pushing coffee down her throat, sitting across from Sylvest with a black oblong table positioned between them. Early morning Resurgam sun was filtering into the room via half-closed jalousies, casting fiery contours across her skin.
"I need your opinion on something."
"Visitors?
How astute."
She poured him a cup, offered the palm of her hand towards the chair. Sylvest sank down into the seat, until he was the lower of the two.
"Indulge my curiosity, Dr. Sylvest, and tell me exactly what you've heard."
"I've heard nothing."
"Then it won't take much of your time."
He smiled through the fog of tiredness. For the second time in a day he had been awakened by her guards, dragged in a state of semi-consciousness and disorientation from his room. He still smelt Pascal, her scent cloaking him, and wondered if she was still sleeping in her own cell somewhere across Mantell. As lonely as he now felt, the feeling was tempered by the gladdening news that she was alive and unharmed. They had told him as much in the days before their meeting, but he had had no reason to believe Sluka's people were telling the truth. What use, after all, was Pascal to the true Pathers? Even less than he, and it was already clear enough that Sluka had been debating the value of retaining him alive. Yet now, perceptibly, things were changing. He had been allowed time with Pascal, and he believed that this would not be the only occasion. Did this development stem from some basic humanity on Sluka's behalf, or did it imply something entirely different? Perhaps that she might have need of one of them in the near future, and that now was the time when she had to begin winning favor. Sylvest swigged the coffee, blasting away his residual tiredness.
"All I've heard is that there may be visitors. From then on I drew my own conclusions,
which I presume you'd care to share with me.
Perhaps we could discuss Pascal for a moment."
She peered at him over the rim of her cup, before nodding with the delicacy of a clockwork marionette.
"You're venturing an exchange of knowledge in return for what? Certain relaxations in the regime under which you're held?"
"That wouldn't be unreasonable, I feel."
"It would all depend on the quality of your speculations."
"Speculations?
As to who these visitors might be?"
Sluka glanced towards the slatted rising sun, eyes narrowed against the ruby-red glare.
"I value your point of view, though heaven knows why."
"First, you'd have to tell me what it is you know."
"We'll come to that."
Sluka bit on a smile.
"First, I should admit that I have you at something of a disadvantage."
"In what way?"
"Who are these people, if they aren't Remilliard's crew?"
Her remark meant that his conversations with Pascal, and by implication everything that had gone on between them, had been monitored, The knowledge shocked him less than he would have expected. He had obviously suspected it must be so the whole time, but perhaps he had preferred to ignore his own qualms.
"Very good, Slooker. You ordered Falkender to mention the visitors, didn't you? That was quite clever of you."
"Falkender was just doing his job."
"Who are they, then?"
"Remilliard already has experience trading with Resurgam. Wouldn't it make sense for him to return here for a second bite?"
"Much too soon. He'll have barely had time to reach another system, let alone anything with trading prospects."
Sylvester freed himself of the chair's embrace, strolling to the slatted window. Through the iron jalousies, he watched the northerly faces of the nearest mesas radiate cool orange, like stacked books on the point of bursting into flame. The thing he noticed now was the bluer tone of the sky. No longer crimson. That was because megatons of dust had been removed from the winds, replaced with water vapor. Or maybe it was a trick of his impaired color perception. Fingering the glass, he said,
"Remilliard would never return so quickly. He's among the shrewdest of traders, with very few exceptions."
"Then who is it?"
"It's the exceptions I'm bothered about."
Slooker called an aide to remove the coffee. With the table bare, she invited Sylvester back to his seat. Then she printed a document from the table and offered it to him.
"The information you're about to see reached us 3 weeks ago, from a contact in the East Nekabet Flare Watch station."
Sylvester nodded. He knew about the flare watches. He had pushed to set them up himself. Small observatories dotted around Resurgam, monitoring the star for evidence of abnormal emission. Reading was too much like trying to decipher Amarantine script, creeping letter by letter along a word until the meaning snapped into his mind. Cal had known that much of reading boiled down to mechanics, the physiology of eye movement along the line. He had built routines into Sylvester's eyes to accommodate this need, but it had not been within Falkander's gift to restore everything. Still, this much was clear. The flare watch in East Nekabet had picked up an energy pulse, much brighter than anything seen previously. Briefly, there was the worrying possibility that Delta Pavonis was about to repeat the flare which had wiped out the Amarantine, the vast coronal mass ejection known as the Event. But closer examination revealed that the flare did not originate from the star, but rather from something several light hours beyond it, on the edge of the system. Analysis of the spectral pattern of the gamma-ray flash indicated that it was subject to a small but measurable Doppler shift, a few percent of the speed of light. The conclusion was inescapable. The flash originated from a ship, on the final phase of deceleration from interstellar cruising speed.
"Something happened," Sylvester said, absorbing the news of the ship's demise with calm neutrality. "Some kind of malfunction in the drive." "That was our guess as well."
Slooker tapped the paper with her fingernail.
"A few days later we knew it couldn't possibly be the case. The thing was still there, faint but unmistakable."
"The ship survived the blast?"
"Whatever it was. By then we were getting a detectable blue shift off the drive flame. Deceleration was continuing normally, as if the explosion had never happened."
"You've got a theory for this, I presume?"
"Half of one. We think the blast originated from a weapon. What kind, we haven't a clue. But nothing else could have liberated so much energy."
"A weapon?"
Sylvester tried to keep his voice completely calm, allowing only natural curiosity to show, purging it of the emotions he really felt, which were largely variations on pure dread.
"Odd, don't you think?"
Sylvester leant forwards, a damp chill along his spine.
"These visitors, whoever they are, I presume they understand the situation here."
"The political picture, you mean?" "Unlikely."
"But they'd have attempted contact with Cuvier."
"That's the funny thing. Nothing from them. Not a squeak.
Who knows this?"
His voice by now was almost inaudible, even to himself, as if someone were standing on his windpipe.
"About 20 people on the colony. People with access to the observatories. A dozen or so of us here. Somewhat fewer in Resurgam City. Cuvier."
"It isn't Remilliard."
Slooker let the paper be reabsorbed by the table, its sensitive content digested away.
"Then do you have any suggestions as to who it might be?"
Sylvester wondered how close to hysteria his laugh sounded.
If I'm right about this, and I'm not often wrong, this isn't just bad news for me, Slooker. This is bad news for all of us. Go on. It's a long story.
She shrugged. I'm not going anywhere in a hurry.
Nor are you.
Not for now, certainly.
What?
Just a suspicion of my own.
Stop playing games, Sylvester.
He nodded, knowing there was no real point in holding back. He had shared the deepest of his fears with Pascal already, and for Slooker it would now be just a case of filling in the gaps, things which were unobvious from her eavesdropping. If he resisted, he knew, she would find a way to learn what she wished, either from him or, worse, Pascal.
It goes back a long way, he said, way back to the time when I just returned to Yellowstone from the Shrouders. You recall that I disappeared back then, don't you?
You always denied anything had happened.
I was kidnapped by ultras, Sylvester said, not wanting to observe her reaction. Taken aboard a light hugger in orbit around Yellowstone. One of their number was injured, and they wanted me to repair him, I suppose.
Repair him?
The captain was an extreme chimeric.
Slooker shivered. It was clear that, like most colonialists, her experience with the radically altered fringes of ultra-society had been confined largely to lurid holodramas.
They were not ordinary ultras, Sylvester said, seeing no reason not to play on Slooker's phobias. They'd been out there too long away from what we'd think of as normal human existence. They were isolated even by normal ultra standards. Paranoid. Militaristic.
But even so.
I know what you're thinking. That even if these were some outlandish offshoot culture, how bad could they be?
Sylvester deployed a supercilious smile and shook his head.
That's exactly what I thought at first. Then I found out more about them.
Such as?
You mentioned a weapon? Well, they have them. They have weapons which could comfortably dismantle this planet, should they wish.
But they wouldn't use them without reason.
Sylvester smiled. We'll find out when they reach Resurgam, I think.
Yes.
Slooker said this last word on a falling note.
Actually, they're already here. The explosion happened 3 weeks ago, but the, significance of it was not immediately clear. In the meantime, they've decelerated and assumed orbit around Resurgam.
Sylvester took a moment to regulate his breathing, wondering just how deliberate Slooker's piecewise revelation was. Had she really neglected to mention this detail? Or had she spared it, disclosing the facts in a manner calculated to keep him permanently disorientated? If so, she was succeeding admirably.
Wait a minute, Sylvester said. Just now you said only a few people knew about this, but how easy would it be to miss a lighthugger orbiting a planet?
Easier than you imagine. Their ship's the darkest object in the system. It radiates in the infrared, of course.
It must do.
But it seems able to tune its emissions to the frequencies of our atmospheric vapor bands. The frequencies which don't penetrate down to the surface. If we hadn't spent the last 20 years putting so much water into the atmosphere.
Slooker shook her head ruefully.
In any case, it doesn't matter. Right now, no one's paying much attention to the sky. They could have arrived lit up in neon and no one would have noticed.
But instead they haven't even announced their presence.
Worse than that, they've done everything possible not to let us know they're here. Except for that damn weapon blast.
For a moment she trailed off, looking towards the window, before snapping her attention back to Sylvester.
If these people are who you think, you must have an idea what it is they want.
That's easy enough, I think. What they want is me.
Volyova listened intently to the rest of Sojaki's report from the surface.
Very little information had reached Yellowstone from Resurgam, even less after the first mutiny. We now know that Sylvester survived the mutiny, but was ousted in a coup 10 years later. 10 years ago from the present date. He was imprisoned, in some luxury, I might add, at the expense of the new regime, who saw him as a useful political tool. Such a situation would have suited us extremely well, since Sylvester's whereabouts would have been easy to deduce. We would also have been in the fortunate position of being able to negotiate with people who might have had few qualms about turning him over to us. Now, however, the situation is immeasurably more complex.
Sajaki paused at this point, and Volyova noticed that he had turned slightly, bringing a new background into view behind him. Their angle of sight was altering as they passed overhead and to the south, but Sajaki was aware of this and was making the necessary adjustments in his position to keep his face in view of the ship at all times. To an observer on one of the other mesas, he would have looked strange indeed, a silent figure facing the horizon, whispering unguessable incantations, slowly pivoting on his heels with almost watch-like precision. No one could have guessed that he was engaged in one-way communication with an orbiting spacecraft, rather than lost in the observance of some private madness.
As we ascertained as soon as we were in scan range, the capital Cuvier has been gutted by a number of large explosions. As we were also able to deduce by examining the degree of reconstruction, these events happened very recently on the colonial timescale. My investigations here have established that the second coup, when these weapons were used, took place barely 8 months ago. However, the coup was not entirely successful. The old regime still control what remains of Cuvier, though their leader, Gerardio, was killed during the disturbance. The True Path inundationists, those responsible for the attacks, control many of the outlying settlements, but they seem to lack cohesion and may even have fallen into factional squabbles. In the week in which I have been here, there have been 9 attacks against the city and some suspect internal saboteurs, True Path infiltrators working from within the ruins.
Sajaki collected his thoughts at this point, and Volyova wondered if he felt some distant kinship with the infiltrators he had mentioned. If so, there was not a hint of it in his expression.
Concerning my own actions, my first task, of course, was to order the suit to dismantle itself. It would have been tempting to use it to make the journey overland to Cuvier, but the risk would have been excessive. Yet the journey was easier than I had feared, and on the outskirts, I hitched a ride with a gang of pipeline technicians returning from the north, using them as cover to enter Cuvier. They were suspicious at first, but the vodka soon persuaded them to take me aboard their vehicle. I told them we distilled it in Phoenix, the settlement where I said I'd come from. They'd never heard of Phoenix, but they were more than happy to drink to it.
Volyova nodded. The vodka, along with a satchel full of trinkets, had been manufactured aboard ship shortly before Sajaki's departure.
People mostly live underground now, in catacombs, which were dug 50 or 60 years ago. Of course, the air is tolerably adapted for breathing, but you have my assurance that the procedure is not exactly comfortable, and one is never far away from the onset of hypoxia. The exertion which was required to reach this mesa was considerable.